Hello and welcome to the Tudor Her Story. Today we are talking to James Peacock, or you may know him best as the Anne Boleyn Society. Today we are talking about Anne Boleyn and her time as Queen of England. Let's delve into the episode. Hello, James. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Jess. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. So today we're talking about Anne Boleyn as the Queen of England. And obviously you are the expert when it comes to Anne Boleyn.
That's very kind of you to say. I don't know about that, but thank you very much.
But I thought we'd quickly ask a little bit about you. And I was wondering, what drew you to Tudor history?
Oh, that's a really good question. I remember getting really interested in the Tudors and Anne Boleyn as a child. And I can't actually remember, frustratingly, what it was that started it all. But I do remember as a young child, I was absolutely obsessed with the Tudors, with Anne Boleyn, with the Queens. And I loved watching Anne of a Thousand Days, Elizabeth R. So Anne of a Thousand Days, a film with Genevieve Bujold and Richard Burton. Elizabeth R obviously has the fantastic late Glenda Jackson playing Elizabeth. And that's kind of really what helps kind of encourage, as it were, that interest. And yeah, so that's really kind of what kind of encouraged it rather than start it, because obviously it was already there beforehand. But yeah, it's kind of been there ever since, really. Yeah,
I mean, that's great. I mean, I love Anne of a Thousand Days and Elizabeth R. I think they are the classics. I know they've got inaccuracies, but the costuming and the scenery and the setting, I think, is so Tudor. It's just, that's perfect to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Elizabeth R with the costumes, it's like Elizabeth stepping out of the paintings, really. They've done it so well. And yeah, very much so, yeah.
Would you say that watching all these programmes is what drew you specifically to Anne Boleyn, or was there something else that made you think, I really like Anne Boleyn?
I would say it definitely helped spear that interest more, kind of encourage it. And I would definitely say whenever I read like about her in any of the history books, there was something about Anne Boleyn that just drew me to her. Her story was such a captivating one, you know, beheaded on these outlandish charges, but also there was just something about her in general that was just so intriguing that I just wanted to learn more, really.
Would you say that's why you started the Anne Boleyn, the Queen Anne Boleyn Society, because of that interest?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I'd say that started it. I think I realised that there was quite an interest in Anne Boleyn, you know, in general. So, yeah, starting up a society kind of felt like it was like she needed one, really. Yeah, so it'll be 10 years in a couple of months now that I started it up. But yeah, so about that, yeah.
I mean, it's an absolutely wonderful page. I love it on Instagram and Facebook, so I can't recommend it enough to people.
Oh, thank you. That's really kind. Thank you.
No problem. I love it. I think your content is amazing, so I can't recommend it enough. So on to the main lady herself. Obviously, Anne Boleyn, well, we think she was born in 1501, but we're focusing on her as the Queen of England, which, in my opinion, is quite overlooked. I think it's either the courtship or her downfall. It's not the in-between period.
Yeah.
Was there anything you'd say Anne had to learn when she knew that she'd become the Queen of England?
Yeah, I think I think there's quite a lot she'd have had to learn, like particularly her duties as queen. You know, she will have obviously had an interesting, unique experience of this, being both at the courts of like Margaret of Austria and then the court of France, and seeing how a lot of those ladies, you know, Margaret of Austria was obviously a regent, so she's pretty much queen, not quite queen in her own right, but she kind of almost is. And obviously then she's seeing Queen Claude, but she's also seeing people like Louise of Savoy in France, you know, ruling as regent for her son Francois, Marguerite of Angoulême as well. She's seeing how they're conducting themselves. So there's a lot of, you know, and obviously, you know, again, Catherine of Aragon too. You know, she would have learned something from her too as well. So there's this, a lot of it will be stuff like her duties as queen that she would have had to have learned, and the role that she was kind of expected to play. And yeah, the kind of both the pluses and the negatives that she would have learned, like the restrictions of her role too, because obviously being a queen consort in that time as well, the expectations on her too, to give birth to this male heir, which, you know, we kind of, you know, not overlooked today, but I think it's hard for us to, you know, understand just how much pressure there would have been for her back then, really, and all the queens as well, really. But yeah, so there was quite a lot she had to learn, really.
Would you say, like, obviously, when Anne agreed to marry the king, that she knew that her life would be changing, and she'd have to start acting a certain way? You know, she couldn't just be a courtier anymore. She was the future of England, or so to speak. Would you say her life changed for that?
Definitely, yeah, because, you know, back then they believed that the king, the monarch, was God's appointed on earth. And so she would have been seeing that as almost like an appointment by God, really. She's seen that elevation, as it were. So, yeah, there would have, she would have really have, it would have had quite, I would imagine, a huge effect on her. You know, here she is almost, you know, almost like the king has chosen God speaking through, you know, sorry, the God has chosen the king, you know, he speaks through, you know, the king is God's appointed on earth. So in a way, it would have probably been seen for her like God was appointing her as well to be queen. So yeah, there was, it would have had a huge profound effect, really, yeah.
Yeah, I almost imagine that she was probably then under an extreme amount of pressure. You know, she couldn't act, not normally, because obviously there was societal norms, but she had to be completely different now. Like, she had a reputation almost that couldn't be damaged anymore.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, she, you almost like, really, there was, you know, she, like Elizabeth, her daughter, famously says when she becomes queen that she's no ordinary woman now. She is, there's two separate Elizabeths. There's Elizabeth the Queen, Elizabeth the Woman. And if you, people have watched like the series The Crown on Netflix, it's kind of talked about there when, you know, the late Queen Elizabeth II came to the throne, and, you know, the whole public face that she put on and the private one. And that was now the same for Anne. There was Anne the Queen and Anne the Woman as well. So she had a, basically, she was now no ordinary person. She had a different role entirely to play.
Yeah. Would you say when Anne, because Anne was mistress to, I say mistress in air quotes, she, as we don't, as far as we know, she never officially slept with Henry before marriage. Did she use her influence for good in 7 years running up to her queenship?
Yeah, I would say she would have done. She will have, I mean, you know, it's always, I mean, people are always going to have their own different views on this, you know, of, you know, whether it was good or whether it could have been selfish or something, you know. Obviously, she would have had her agenda like anyone would have done to promote. So, you know, there's the whole story of, you know, her supposedly promoting the Reformation and the new ideas to Henry, and, you know, having those sort of conversations with him, the people that she had round her. You know, there was Cranmer, who was already like working with the Boleyn family. So there was that kind of, you know, she had her own sort of influence at that time as well that she was building upon, that when she would become queen she would exercise more. So I would say, yeah, there was definitely a lot of that kind of influence, and you see the early starts of that with the whole, her interest in the Reformation, the people that she's surrounding herself with. It's very much starting in those, even in the early days of that whole, the great matter, as it were, yeah, when it all starts really beginning, yeah.
So when we're going to move to 1533, when in January, oh, I want to say the 25th of January. Is it the 25th? It's the 25th. Yes, I
Yeah,
remembered.
this is well
She
remembered.
marries Henry
This
VIII. She marries Henry
is
VIII. And on the 1st of June, she's coronated Queen of England. When was her actual official debut as queen? Because I believe it's before the coronation.
That's right, yeah, it's in about April time as well, when so there's the date where Henry informs his council that he has married Anne, probably one of the worst kept secrets of that by that point. And the next day after that, she makes her debut as queen at service at court, decked out in jewels, as it were. So yeah, that's pretty much her first kind of debut as queen, as it were, yeah.
Do we know of the court's reaction to her public debut? Were there any fe feathers ruffled at all?
Oh, there were definitely feathers ruffled. I mean, you have to read, Jacques's dispatch, and yeah, he says, people didn't know whether to laugh or cry. He said it all had looked like a dream. And yeah, there were definitely, I mean, I think people would have expected it by that point. They knew it was coming. Henry had kind of started the whole process separating with Rome. He had put aside, poor Catherine of Aragon. But he, yeah, there was definitely kind of, they knew it was kind of on the cards. And by that point, the marriage would have been kind of a very badly kept secret. The rumors were circulating that she was pregnant. People were told that, appointments to her household was on the way, and people could, soon be applying for those roles. Coronation talk was started. So I think people were very much expecting it. It was like one of those long overdue things where, once it happens, they're like, well, we knew this was coming. But it definitely, yeah, would have, because she, we have to remember she also had a lot of enemies at court as well. People who very much supported Catherine of Aragon, saw her as the usurper. So yeah, she definitely, had, she had a, yeah, it was difficult. It was probably, there was definitely a mixed reaction.
Yeah, I think with Anne Boleyn, and I still think it is true today, you either love her or you hate her. It's kind of
Yeah.
she's a bit like Marmite a little bit.
Yes, and usually those are the most interesting people in history, really.
I mean, absolutely, like, I mean, I love her, so she
Yeah.
can't do any wrong in my eyes.
Brilliant. This is...
When could you tell us a little bit about the celebrations for her coronation and the, not the celebrations, when it's the procession to her coronation and afterwards?
Yeah, so her coronation was obviously an incredibly grand affair, almost on the scale of that of a monarch, really, than a consort. And it all starts off with, first of all, you have this amazing river water pageant with loads of different boats. There's supposed to be a with loads of mechanical things going on, and it's incredibly decorative. The next day is her procession, where she goes through, sorry, not the next day, the day after, 2 days after that is like the procession where she's going through London, which, people usually did before the coronation. There were lots of pageants performed. And there's an awful lot during this of religious themes and themes that are, basically hinting at, a lot of it is like the pressure on her to bring forth, because at this point she's 6 months pregnant, and there's a lot of expectation and hope for her to be giving birth to a son. So a lot of the pageants are kind of talking about the new male heir that's going to come, that's going to, change England, continue the Tudor dynasty. There's a lot of pressure there as well as the celebrations for her too. And also there's a prominent roles for the French too, showing her links to France. But also, there's talks about the change, the Reformation as well. And then of course you have her coronation day, the 1st of June, which is an incredibly grand affair. And coronation ceremonies then a lot longer than what we saw last year for current King Charles III. It went on for quite a number of hours, and there's a lot of heavy religious services in there. It would have been quite grueling for Anne as well, as well as being an incredible day for her too, being crowned queen at long last, because again, she is 6 months pregnant. There's even talk that she had to take a break at one point because, you know, being so heavily pregnant as well. Yeah, so it's very much, but it's very much interesting. It's very much her show. Henry stays, apart from greeting her at the tower, and, you know, watching the coronation from behind. So, you know, he's very much kind of staying out of it all, kind of, because it's very much Anne's show at that moment. And most incredibly of all, he has her crowned with the crown of St. Edward's, which is usually only used for a monarch. And that is kind of takes her separate from most other consorts. And the reason why he does that, obviously a lot of people will have their own views on this, but it's very much that kind of, he's basically saying, A, she's my true wife now, but also he's crowning the unborn child as well, you know, which is basically saying this male heir, he's basically saying this is a legitimate child. So there's, you know, there's a lot of these hidden messages in that. And then obviously afterwards they have the whole banquets and everything as they usually did, you know, at Westminster Hall and everything. So yeah, it's a very, her coronation celebrations in themselves are very, very, yeah, very interesting.
No, I agree. I mean, it must have been absolutely magnificent to witness. I can't imagine. But again, do we know how the public and the courtiers reacted to such this public coronation? You know, Anne was at the forefront.
It's, again, it's kind of like a mixed thing, really. There's often been this kind of, you know, a bit of a misconception that people booed or hissed her. There's one account that says that she, you know, famously wore, like, so it looked like she came out in a dress for her coronation procession wearing, like, tongues pierced to one of her dresses, which is completely ridiculous. Chapuys does say that he says that it was very more, it was quite a somber reaction. But of course, some people could say that he had his agenda to say that. We have to also remember that there was free, excuse me, free wine being provided by the king to flow for the citizens of London. And that would have gotten people very merry after a few drinks. So there will have been a mixed reaction. There would have been people, you know, supporting it. People would have been enjoying it. But there would have been people, you know, like in any situation, you know, sympathizing very much with Catherine of Aragon, Finch, you know, and yeah, feeling that this whole situation was incredibly wrong. But yeah, it was a bit of a mix, really, I'd say.
Yeah. Do you think, even though this was a momentous occasion for Anne, you know, she had secured everything she had worked for, she now knew she had to deliver her end of the bargain almost, and if she didn't, she would be in the same position as Catherine of Aragon?
I think definitely there would have been that kind of almost fear at the back of her mind. We talk about how, you know, Anne and Henry were very confident about being a male heir, and, you know, they had prepared like all the dispatches for the birth of their prince, but I do think at the back of their mind there must have been that fear as well. And you know, Anne was in a very vulnerable position because, unlike, say, Catherine, who was a princess of Spain, Anne wasn't a princess in her own right. She was basically from the nobility. What had risen her to the position she was in was the love of the king. And as we know, when that love turned against her, it left her very vulnerable. Now, she had seen Catherine of Aragon obviously being put aside after a number of years. She would have convinced herself, if she hadn't believed it already, that it was the right thing for her then to be queen. But I don't feel she would ever have expected it, what eventually happened to have happened. No one could have foreseen that. It's very easy with the benefit of hindsight, you know, for us all to look back and think, well, of course he would have done that. He did this. And then, you know, we know how it ended just a few years later. They would never have foreseen that then. But I think there would have been that kind of vulnerability that we then see creep in once, you know, after Elizabeth's born, once Anne starts having miscarriages, that vulnerability and that fear that she starts to feel. So I think that would have been there, definitely.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I can't imagine what she must have felt like at all. And I agree with you again that no one was expecting Anne to be executed. It was still a shock, even when she was in the tower, that she was executed. They still thought she'd be put in a nunnery and that would be the end of it.
Yeah.
Do we know of some of the immediate changes Anne made as Queen of England, you know, to the ladies around her and her day-to-day life?
I mean, she will have, you know, I don't think there were quite the immediate changes, as it were, but there were, like, changes. She obviously brought in her own new household and everything. So it would have been very different to, say, how, for example, Catherine of Aragon did things. It would have been a very different atmosphere. Same when eventually Jane Seymour then took over. So there was almost, like, this new kind of, you know, new ideas that coming in. So I think, you know, Anne's changes had kind of already been coming before she became queen. She had been around for quite a while. Henry had kind of almost treated her as an unofficial, uncrowned queen before she was queen. So I think that any changes that happened when Anne was queen were things that had already been in place in her household for quite some time. People would have expected, really.
Do we know if Anne try to make her ladies act a certain way? For example, I think it's believed Jane Seymour banned her ladies from wearing the French hood. I don't know if that's been myth busted recently, but did Anne try to make changes to, like, set an example to her ladies? You know, you've got to behave like this.
Yeah, there was definitely, we know that she had them all, you know, swear upon the Bible. One of her, you know, her chaplains wrote the Treaty, the Chronicle of Anne Boleyn, and he basically talks about how Anne instructed her ladies to behave a certain way, would have written swear upon the Bible, would have them acting in charitable causes, and he provides a kind of first-hand witness account to that. So we do know that she was definitely, you know, making her ladies, you know, behave in certain ways, reading obviously the Bible, you know, the new Bibles that she had put in there as well. And yeah, we definitely know from his accounts that she was instructing her ladies quite a bit, and, you know, quite involved actually in religion. And that's something that's often been kind of overlooked really a lot, is Anne's role in religion. You know, we tend to focus on, say, Catherine of Aragon being very religious, very pious, but we don't really focus on the fact that Anne was also a very religious woman too. And it's only really in recent years that people have actually really started to look at that.
No, I agree. It's quite overlooked that how pious Anne was. You know, you only have to see her Books of Hours to realise she was quite a pious woman. Would you say Anne was a charitable queen more so than the other wives of Henry?
I don't know about being more charitable than the other wives. Obviously, they all had their own sort of beliefs, and I think they were all charitable, you know, in their own ways. It's easier to kind of see it more with, say, Catherine of Aragon, Anne Boleyn, because, you know, Catherine obviously was there for, like, queen for about 20 odd years. Anne had been around for a few years before she becomes queen, and unfortunately, with people like Anne of Cleves, for example, we have very little time to really see her implement that. But I would definitely say she was, there are numerous acts of her charitableness that sadly get very overlooked. But yeah, that's definitely something that we, you know, has, yeah. So I would definitely say she was an incredibly charitable queen. And yeah, it's sad that that's been quite overlooked, but there are quite a few acts of that charity that she performs.
No, I mean, I agree with you again. It's just, I think Anne's, which is why we're talking about it today, Anne's reign is quite overlooked. Would you say that she tried to make a positive change as queen?
Definitely. And it would have been really interesting to see how, you know, if her last child, which was claimed to be a boy and everything, had carried full term, been born, eventually become king, it would have been interesting to see how things would have progressed then with her still around. Would the dissolution of the monasteries been as severe and as bloody as it was, you know, or would it have been slightly differently? Because by that point, Cromwell had a lot more power, you know, and he and Anne had clashed. We know that she wanted, you know, the money from the dissolved monastery to be used for charitable purposes to educate the underprivileged, and, you know, so things like that. She wanted, you know, things to be used for good. And so I think there is definitely, yeah, she definitely did try to use that, she did try to use her role for good as well.
No, I agree. Do we know what Anne was a patron of as queen?
Yeah, so she was definitely, we know she was definitely a patron. She loved music and the arts, and, you know, she had a vast library that she kept. She loved illuminated manuscripts. She was said to be a great musician in her own right, you know, performing like the lute, singing very well. Even accounts from people like George Cavendish, who doesn't particularly like Anne because, you know, he blames her for the downfall of his master, Cardinal Wolsey. One thing he will say is that Anne was a brilliant, you know, musician, had a brilliant singing voice. So she definitely was, you know, a huge patron of arts and things. She definitely, you know, supported, you know, people who had seeked out religious, been in exile from their countries. You know, we know, for example, the French reformist Nicolas Bourbon, who she patroned and appointed as nephew to her, sorry, as tutor to her nephew, Henry. So there was definitely a lot of people that she did patron and stuff as well. And yeah, there's definitely quite a lot of evidence of that.
Would you say one of the qualities Anne had was that she was a builder? You know, obviously we could talk about it in more detail, but at Hampton Court, she was having the Queen's rooms, I think it was newly made or reconstructed.
Yeah, definitely. So we know from so many of the records that Anne and Henry basically designed the new palace of Hampton Court together. You know, we know that they worked on that very closely. They came by quite often to see the work progressing. Sadly, nowadays, there's been a lot of changes at the palace. Well, I say sadly, obviously, you could argue times do change, obviously, but, you know, the Great Hall, for example, that still survives is basically what I always say is the stamp of Anne's queenship. And, you know, so, yeah, there's definitely a lot of influence. And sadly, also, another place as well was Whitehall Palace, which is now pretty much all gone. Well, it is all gone. And that was another place where she was very much involved in the building work there, the design of it all. So, yeah, she was definitely a great builder for the palaces. In fact, I believe, you know, Professor Simon Furley has basically said that she's almost kind of given her the credit of having speared on Henry's interest with, you know, building as well, because it's from his time with Anne onwards that he starts becoming the builder of palaces that we know him as. She would have obviously been, you know, in Mechelen, and obviously in France, you would have seen all these great buildings, chateaus, you know, and all that. And there's a slight similarity if you think of some of the way like Hampton Court would be built. So say if you look at like the red bricks of, say, Palace of Mechelen and stuff, there's a lot of similarities there. So definitely kind of had her interest there. And that's something that, again, I think has been very overlooked, is Anne's involvement in, you know, the building of the palaces and stuff. Yeah.
No, I agree. I mean, I went to Hampton Court again last year and I got to see the falcon that was
Oh,
rediscovered.
brilliant. Yeah.
Would they have been all over the Great Hall, do you
Yeah,
think?
definitely in the Great Hall there are still some up actually in the ceiling now still, but there's also within her private rooms as well stuff from, yeah, so and on the screens around the minstrels gallery too, so there definitely would have been an awful lot of that.
In your opinion, do you believe Anne was a good queen in the time she had?
Yes, I do. I do think she was a good queen, and I think that it would have been interesting to see her work continue, really. But yeah, no, definitely, I think her legacy is quite a good is a good one, and I may be biased, obviously, but yeah, no, I do think so.
No, I agree. I mean, I think she tried to make a lot of positive changes, especially in education and for the poor. I think it's when you see a different side to Anne, to what people like to believe. What legacy do you believe Anne left behind for her daughter, Elizabeth?
Oh, I think excuse me, I think there's quite a lot of legacies. Unfortunately, it's the good and the bad, you know, that unfortunately, because of her downfall, I think Elizabeth had to play a very careful role, you know, even though and there's the brilliant book by Professor Tracy Borman, you know, Anne Boleyn and Elizabeth I, Mother and Daughter Change History, who really goes into great detail on this, and I'd encourage any listener who hasn't read it to read it. She talks a lot about the legacies that Anne left for Elizabeth, both good and bad, but through her, you know, through her work with a lot of her chaplains as well. We know the story that she asked one of her chaplains to, you know, to look after Elizabeth, basically look out for it if anything should happen to her, Matthew Parker, and he goes on to become Elizabeth's first Archbishop of Canterbury. So he's obviously looked after Elizabeth's spiritual welfare. So that's a huge impact in history, that, you know, a huge legacy there to leave behind. He worked very closely with Anne. He found working with Elizabeth quite challenging and said that, you know, he would not have taken up the role of Archbishop had he not felt so honour bound to Anne. So there's clearly a great connection that he's felt to Anne, and then he's obviously becoming this Archbishop of Canterbury, one of the most highest positions in the land. So that's a huge legacy to leave behind. There's also, you know, the works that she had by Marguerite of Angoulême, which Elizabeth then goes and translates for her final stepmother, Catherine Parr. So there's obviously, you know, a bit of a literacy legacy too. Music as well, if you're taking, for example, that Elizabeth was set to own a set of virginals that, you know, had her mother's falcon on it as well. So there's definitely some hidden legacies there that, you know, which it's maybe hard to sort of connect to and kind of pinpoint where it began, but there's definitely a lot of, yeah, different connections and stuff there from mother to daughter, really.
No, I agree. A fantastic book as well that you've just recommended. I love that book so much.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you one final question about Anne. What do you believe we should remember about her?
Oh, that's a really good question. What can we remember about Anne? Oh, I can't, I don't know if I can. One, I don't know. I would say definitely, I would say her religious aspects. I think that as we've been talking about that in this podcast, I think that's something that we need to remember more, really, is just how religious she was, how serious she took it, how much she believed in the Reformation. Whether she would have been eventually a full-on Protestant is hard to tell. Obviously, in her lifetime, the lines between Catholic and Protestant weren't as clear as they would later become, but she certainly believed in reform from within the Catholic Church, and I think that's something we need to remember a lot more than we've, you know, than does get remembered, sadly, with Anne.
No, I agree. Before I let you go, I ask all my guests five fun Tudor questions.
Okay.
Firstly, have you got a favourite book when it comes to Anne Boleyn? It can be historical fiction or just non-fiction.
Oh, I think my favorite will always have to be, I'm always going to have a soft spot for Eric Ives's The Life and Death of Anne Boleyn. It's very much what I consider the Anne Boleyn Bible. Definitely. I do also absolutely love Sandra Basile's fiction work, Truth and Jaws, Anne Boleyn's memoirs. That is an absolute fantastic book, and I would encourage everyone to get out there and read it because she's really done an amazing job at bringing Anne to life and really telling her story through her voice.
No, I haven't read Sandra Basile's book. I need to buy it soon. I've read the Anne Boleyn Bible, as you call it, because I call it the Anne Boleyn Bible as well. Have you got a favourite portrayal of Anne on screen?
Well, that's going to be no surprise considering the start of the interview, but it'll definitely be Jean-Pierre Bujold, 100%. I do have to say, though, as well, I do have a lot of time for Natalie Dormer as well. I know the Tudors has some alarming inaccuracies, but reading from some of the stuff behind the scenes about when Natalie challenged the producers to give a more fair portrayal to Anne, to show Anne's role in the Reformation, that I really. My respect for her went up a lot, and she clearly took that role very seriously. So now I do have a lot of time for her as well.
No, I agree. I know the Tudors can get a bad rep, but hit when you read and again, as you say, about Natalie fighting for a more nuanced portrayal of Anne, it's like, yes, go on, keep petitioning. This is my favourite question that I'm going to ask. Have you got a Tudor pet peeve?
Oh gosh, Tudor pet peeve. There's so many. I'm trying to struggle now to pick just one, and I know what's going to happen. I'm going to finish up this interview, and I'm going to think. Actually, I've got one. I can think. I'll think of about three more. I would say mostly at the moment, it's the kind of, it's the belief. And there is annoyingly this alarming belief, which people are going to be like, listen and think, really? No, that can't be true. But they do still believe that there are people out there that still believe that Anne had six fingers. And that, I would say at the moment, is my biggest pet peeve. That's the most fresh one for me because I've had that experience recently. So I would say at the moment, that's the forefront of my mind. But I will think of about 10 more within the next few hours.
No, I mean, when someone says, "Oh, she had six fingers," I'm like, no, she didn't. Let's correct ourselves before we have a conversation. I mean, this might be an obvious one, but have you got a favourite historical building?
I'm gonna have to go with Hampton Court Palace because, and I'm gonna be biased because I work there, obviously. So I get to be in like the Great Hall and various locations. So I would say that is definitely a very special one. You go there, you can see the stamp still of Anne's queenship at the Great Hall and other places as well. There's a lot that ties her in. It was basically, yeah, she all her hopes and dreams as queen lay there, basically. So, but I do also have a love as well for Hever Castle, which I think you get to learn about Anne more, the woman as well, there as well. So it would have to be very much split between those two.
Final question, have you got a favourite history fact?
Oh gosh. Favorite history fact. Ooh. I wouldn't say I've got an actual favorite one, to be honest. I would say that, there's a few of them that I have, but I would say they mostly, I think, to be honest, we've kind of discussed most of them, to be honest, about in regards to Anne Boleyn, because they tend to be some of my favorites. So I'd have to say that. They would be, yeah, the ones that we've kind of discussed about her religious aspects, which we kind of have already gone into a bit, really. So I can't really say that and just kind of, which is a bit, yeah. But other than that, really, I can't really think of others that I can think of at the moment.
No, that's fair enough. I mean, you've given us lots of history facts about Anne today.
Yes.
Thank you so much for taking the time and coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you about Anne Boleyn today.
Oh no, thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure to be on your podcast as well. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode and you loved all the others, please take the time to rate and review the show.